This is the Poetry Magazine podcast. I'm Don Scher, editor of Poetry Magazine.
And I'm Lindsay Garbutt, managing editor.
We hope you're doing as well as can be wherever you are. Lindsay and I are recording from our new makeshift recording studios.
In other words, from our homes. This week we spoke with Tashani Doshi about her poem, They Killed Cows, I Killed Them.
The poem began when Doshi saw an undercover video shot by a New Delhi-based news organization of a man bragging after he murdered a local meat trader.
We've been in India going through several movements of violence, and this cow vigilantism, these incidents were troubling to me because, I mean, one was the violence and the fact that here you have people who are turning upon men because of suspicions that they either have beef in their home or that they trade in cattle. But the other was the fact that because of technology, they were recording these killings and that these things were being circulated.
Doshi says that in this circulation, the violence becomes multiplied. She believes poetry can convert at least some of the anguish in the world into something that can be grappled with.
I really believe in reclamation as something that poetry can do. Every poem in that sense is trying to reclaim something. And here it would be thinking about the lives of Qasim Qureshi, a meat trader who was 45 years old, Tabrez Ansari, who was tied to a pole and accused of being a thief and beaten to death with sticks and forced to chant Jai Shri Ram. I mean, when we're talking about language, this chant of Jai Shri Ram is actually, you know, was a devout greeting that Hindus would use. And it has now become a battle cry for right-wing fundamentalists. And there's so many things about language that I think I'm trying to do in this poem.
Here's Tashani Doshi reading, They Killed Cows, I Killed Them.
In the future, we might all be vegetarian, and this life will seem barbaric, the way a corset was, or eugenics. We might look at this man being secretly recorded, bragging, they killed cows, I killed them, and wonder, where was his mother? She might have spoken of his childhood, how it was poor but decent, how like that blue god's mother, she too gaped into her son's wide gob and saw the universe once. Or she might have told the story of how he was led astray by a band of men in uniforms, not brown shirts, but pleated brown shorts, in which they practiced ideological calisthenics. How she's been standing at the crater's edge, saying, here, kitty, 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 ever since. Because this man, her son, in the undershirt, dear cadre, cow vigilante, he's no gladiolus. He sighs, even whose mustache is pusillanimous. Maybe he was a Romeo in school. Maybe he wields this stick to reclaim what he misses most about his body. Or maybe it's always been his dream to squeeze the messy limbs of this country into a svelte operatic shriek. The camera gives us a glimpse of his chin dumpling. He will go to jail 1,000 times without passing go, without stopping to plant a tree or collect clean underwear. He admits it was wrong to allow his boys to record the killing. Jai Shri Ram. Silly to leave evidence behind, even though they always go free, even though the young lads enjoy it so. And Qasim, the man they killed, the green meadow of his life come to this? Didn't his mother also once confuse the dirt in his mouth for a galaxy? Didn't he believe a dying man had the right to ask for water? In the future, when people complain about how Gandhi should have made a comeback, when comparisons are drawn between YouTube and the Upanishads, will they notice the bystanders in the frame, their shabby shoes shuffling like lapwings around the bloody censored blur of Kasim's body? Will they speak of the difficulty of watching him thrash around for an invisible rope to steady him home? The difficulty of us watching them, watching him being killed? Or is that an illusion too? The way a magician might swirl his cape to reveal his assistant is really a robot. No damage done here, folks. The way we enter the rooms of our past like gunshots to say, "Surprise, I'm still here." No point carrying blossoms in your pocket instead of a meat sandwich. Because even if you did not walk the earth exultantly, even if you avoided disposable plates and mourned every glacier and strung a lattice of pearls to the giant monument of love, there might still come a day when you are hauling refrigerators on a truck or taking the children to a fair, and when death arrives, you must let him strap you to a telephone pole. You must look into his 10-headed face and say, "Flay, brother, flay."
There's a really eerie link here between technology and a kind of ecology, an ecology in which religious beliefs and practices are so vitally important. And I was trying to think about what that link was. And what the link is for me in this poem is the language of the poem. It's a gorgeous poem, and it's talking about very hard things. And it's, of course, it's not American English. It's a kind of English that bridges all these subjects and kind of brings together with a kind of dignity, but also energy and panache that it's just endlessly striking. It seems to me also that her use of sentences as units, just sort of the gorgeous rhythms of these, as anguished as the poem is, you know, the camera gives us a glimpse of his chin dumpling. He will go to jail 1,000 times without passing go, and so on. This kind of sinuousness of the poem and the sounds in it are a sign of its great strength and dignity and seriousness of purpose. So it is a striking poem, but to my mind, it's also an unusual poem. The way that it sort of forces you to think through things in the unit of a line or phrase in a poem. It's something that Yeats, I think, was the greatest master of, and this poem reminds me of some of Yeats's poems, both in that way that it's constructed, but also its intense political and cultural purposes, and its humanity.
I really was thinking about the same things you were, Don, about the beauty of the sentences and lines here, but also I love the use of stanzas in this poem too, because they're so complete, each one, and yet they build on each other in such a beautiful way. And so the fact that this first stanza is very future-oriented, it's about how these sort of scenes might be viewed in the future if we are all indeed vegetarian and the way this life might look barbaric. But it also looks backward to think about how the mother might have raised this man and about how she might have seen him. And so this both forward and backward looking glance sort of swirls throughout this poem. In the third stanza, it takes the form of all these different questions. But what I really kept being drawn to was this repetition of the "you must" at the end of the poem. And having a "you must" to tie up the end, of course, reminds me of Rilke and "you must change your life." Only here, the "must" refers to how someone accepts their death or has to face their death. And to think about this poem in comparison to Rilke's is to see, you know, that poet was looking at a sculpture and this poet is looking at a video on YouTube. It's, as you were saying, Don, a sort of updated medium or an updated technology that is providing for this experience in this poem.
I love thinking about Rilke here too, because the questions in the poem, Yeats was a good question poet too. Those are poets who put questions into their poems, as well as kind of demands on readers. But the questions here, you know, the man they killed, the green meadow of his life, come to this. Didn't his mother also once confuse the dirt in his mouth for a galaxy? Didn't he believe a dying man had the right to ask for water? The questions that are raised, and there are many in this poem, are kind of unanswerable, except by the idea that you've described that Rilke had, that, you know, you have to change your life, that what you see and what can be thought has to lead to action. It can't just be that you are a spectator like you would be on YouTube. You know, you have to think something, and that the models we have for coping with so much that we're subjected to and so much violence is to make the future possible, if that can be, by looking at something not in the way that you look at sort of a viral video, but looking at it with all the sort of senses and faculties and capabilities of thinking that you can have. That beginning of the poem, you know, wondering where this man's mother was. These are all both questions that poetry raises, but they're also ethical questions, and they're the kinds of things that people don't slow down long enough to think about. And if you don't slow down long enough to think about what's happening in the present, the future isn't going to be possible except as a shambolic, violent wasteland.
Yeah, I love how in that stanza with the questions that you were talking about, Dawn, she writes, when comparisons are drawn between YouTube and the Upanishads, will they notice the bystanders in the frame? And it goes on to think more about this watching that we do, both the watching that is visible within the video itself and then the watching that we do as watchers of the video of the bystanders within the video. It's sort of this endless consideration of what role we play just by being observers and how, as you were saying, can we take action and think more deeply about what it means to view something and what it means to be living in the world at this moment with knowledge of these things that are happening. What more must you do?
Yeah. Being confronted with these questions of who is watching the watchers and having to remind yourself that you have to ask what is an illusion and what we see and what we think we see these are all questions that can only be resolved in the heart and in the mind.
No damage done here, folks. The way we enter the rooms of our past like gunshots to say, surprise, I'm still here.
Tishani Doshi is a poet, novelist, and dancer. Her most recent books are the novel Small Days and Nights from W.W. Norton and the poetry collection Girls Are Coming Out of the Woods from Copper Canyon Press.
You can read They Killed Cows, I Killed Them in the April 2020 issue of Poetry Magazine or online at poetrymagazine.org.
If you're not yet a subscriber to the magazine, and you really should be one, for a limited time, we're offering podcast listeners a special rate of $20. That's $20 for a full year of the freshest voices in contemporary poetry featured in 11 book-length issues, as well as free digital access on our mobile app. Visit poetrymagazine.org/podcast offer to subscribe. That's poetrymagazine.org/podcast offer.
Let us know what you thought of this program. You can review us on Apple Podcasts or email us at podcast@poetryfoundation.org. We'd love to hear your thoughts.
We'll have another episode for you next week, or you can get all April episodes all at once in the full-length podcast on SoundCloud. The podcast is also now available on Spotify.
The Poetry Magazine podcast is produced by Rachel James. The theme music comes from the Claudia Quintet. I'm Lindsay Garbutt.
And I'm Don Scher. Thanks for listening.